I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we talk about the life and legacy of Gary Studs, who served as U.S. Representative to Massachusetts from 1973 to 1997. He's known for passing legislation protecting American fishermen from overfishing by international boats and limiting President Ronald Reagan's wars in Central America. After an affair with a page was revealed, Gary Studs became the first openly gay member of Congress. He went on to champion AIDS research and equal rights for gays. Mark Robert Schneider joins us to talk about his biography. Gary Studs, America's first openly gay congressman. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a really interesting read, and I think a lot of people remember some of the legislative things he's done, but to read about his entire life and the battle that he had all those years, you know, being in the closet before he revealed that he was gay. Let's start with his childhood. He had a pretty idyllic childhood. Tell us about his family and how he grew up.
Yeah, he grew up in Cohasset in a middle-class family, and he went to school at Groton, where he really blossomed and quickly discovered that he was very good at languages and in public policy and history. So he had a great education. He went on from there to Yale. And he looked like the kind of person who was to the manner born. He had a kind of aristocratic bearing. Some people found him a little bit aloof and, I think, intimidating. But he never had that sense of himself. Actually, his parents weren't Yankees. His father descended from Southerners. One part of that family had married into the Elbridge Gary family, and that's what explains his name. And on his mother's side, they were Catholics from New York. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't really an old-line Yankee at all.
See, anyway, and you're right, Gary excelled in school and suffered for it socially. He had been moved ahead one grade and began committing deliberate errors to better fit in with his peers. And that was before he got to Groton.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So then eighth grade, he was accepted into the Distinguished Groton School. And you say he remembered his time at Groton as close to heaven on earth.
He fit in perfectly. The school really values public service. It had a liberal political cast. He was a Republican himself in his early voting patterns, but the atmosphere of the school was really perfect for somebody with a powerful intellect and a wide-ranging curiosity.
Yeah, that surprised me. 1952, 15 years old, he joined the Young Republicans Club. His parents were Republicans. All right, you write, and this is as Gary was college age, I guess, Gary was now old enough to be interested in, Gary was now old enough to be interested in girls, except he wasn't. Luckily for him, attendance at a boys' school limited everyone's interest in girls, and Gary just assumed that he was more or less like everyone else.
Yeah, I interviewed several people with whom he had gone to school, and, the subject, so far as they could tell, the subject of his sexual orientation never came up. He did broach it with people in very roundabout, indirect ways because he knew how explosive it was to present yourself as a homosexual in the 1950s. So they never quite got it. He dated girls, and later he was even engaged to be married, but he broke it off, which was, he shouldn't have done it to begin with. But, he wanted to please his parents and do what he felt was the right and proper thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. It wasn't just please his parents. Remind us of the time and why it was so difficult for someone to admit that they were gay.
Yes. In the 1950s, really, and through the 1960s for the most part, being gay, committing homosexual sex was a crime virtually everywhere. I think Illinois had repealed its anti-sodomy laws in 1962, but virtually everywhere having sex was a crime. It was considered to be a sin by every church. And you were counseled that you would go to hell if you didn't reform yourself. The psychiatric profession regarded homosexuality as a disease to be cured. And in the Eisenhower administration, the president issued an executive order barring homosexuals from the public service because they might be compromised. So the oppression was really quite complete. And as one author has pointed out, black people suffered serious, segregation, discrimination at all levels. But your parents told you what it was going to be like, and you had a community and a church that backed you up. when you were gay, you were in the 50s, you were alone.
You were on your own.
You were on your own with your own secret.
And do you think that when Gary really kind of started to realize that maybe he was homosexual was when he was at Groton and he started to have feelings for one of his football teammates?
Yes.
That was the first indication that he had.
Yes, yes, yeah. And it continued at Yale, but he was never able to find a way to express it.
No. And he, there certainly were communities, they just weren't available to him, for sure.
Yeah, he was quite reserved, too. You know, at one point he went to the library to get out a book about sex. And he looked up homosexual in the back of the book, and he found that the pages were ripped out. So it was kind of a sign to him that he wasn't alone, in that whoever else had ripped those pages out knew that he had to keep it secret, too.
Terrible feeling to not be able to talk to anybody, right, about that? Yeah. Gary was named Director of Education for the Connecticut Committee for Hungarian Refugee Relief. This was an interesting story, I thought. He really had a knack for teaching.
Yes, he was a good teacher, and he had a spectacular ability with languages. Now, Hungarian's a bit of a stretch.
He didn't know Hungarian.
No. But, you know, in 1956, there was the uprising in Hungary, and it produced refugees in the later 50s in the United States, and many of them settled in the New Haven area. And so Studs was led the student committee to help these people resettle.
Right, and so he had a social conscience at a young age.
Yes, he did. Yeah. That was the first way in which it manifested itself. He became a Democrat. His first vote was cast in 1958 for Hastings Keith, the Republican congressman whom he would later run against. But President Kennedy inspired him, and like many young people of his generation, he became a Democrat in the Kennedy campaign.
Yeah. So after college, he was a Foreign Service officer in the State Department. Tell us about that.
Yes. He very quickly found himself in a group that monitored crises. So he'd be on duty for 48 hours reading cables with a senior official, and they were the people who decided, do we wake up the Secretary of State in the middle of the night, you know, at this crisis level. Pretty heady stuff for a young man. Nonetheless, he didn't like the Bay of Pigs invasion, and he was increasingly alarmed by the war in Vietnam. And he began to look for a way out, actually. And he took a position in an interagency committee, which later produced VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America. And he then had to reapply for his position at State, and they didn't let him back in. Mm. And he wasn't totally sure why, but he suspected it was because they suspected that he was a homosexual. Many years later, he was asked to write a memoir. And he sent away for his Freedom of Information Act file. And he got his FBI file. And yeah, sure enough, that was it.
Mm. There were some references in here where some people thought he was a bit arrogant. And I wondered if that was misunderstood.
I believe it. I think it's a combination of two things. The public has, in the United States, we don't elect a lot of intellectuals. You know, Adlai Stevenson didn't do too great in his two campaigns. So from that point of view, he's unusual for a politician. You know, he could read a novel in French. That's not the usual model. So it's off-putting. I think he doesn't feel like the kind of guy you could have a beer with, you know, to some people. Now, the other component of this is that at the beginning of his public career, he was guarding a secret. And it made him defensive in his dealings with people whom he probably suspected were sussing out that he was a homosexual. So I think those two things combined to produce that in his demeanor. Mm-hmm. After he came out, as everybody said, and he said, his demeanor changed, and it was easier for him.
Weight lifted off your shoulders.
Absolutely.
You don't have to look behind you.
Exactly.
Who knows what. Yeah. So after the State Department, he became a teacher at St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire.
Yeah. So he got in trouble there, too. at St. Paul's, this was in 1965, so that's just the period at which the war in Vietnam escalated, and if you're watching the GBH series on the Vietnam War, you know, it takes you back to the intensity of that time period. So Studs was the guy, was the faculty advisor for the anti-war students, and he took his he had in his class Craig McNamara, and I think also the son of Stanley Rezor, the who was the Secretary of the Army. You know, that's the kind of elite student, you know, who was there. Cameron Kerry, Secretary Kerry's brother, was a student at the time. So that's who was there. And these students were turning against the war. And Studs was the guy who kind of gave them permission to do that. So the administration, which was Republican and conservative, kind of came down on him. And it made his situation there difficult.
But he found a way out.
Well, yes. Later. Now, part of the way he now, there's one other very big wrinkle to this story, which is that Eugene McCarthy announced that he was going to run for president in December of 1967. But and McCarthy later became the model for Studs, kind of cerebral, reserved guy who also looked a little bit aloof to many people. McCarthy never anticipated that he would win the presidency, and he wanted to make a point about the war in Vietnam, and he only planned to run in a couple of the Midwestern states near his native Minnesota. And Studs convinced him. There weren't a lot of liberals at the top in the Democratic Party in New Hampshire. Studs and a colleague, a man called David Ho, convinced McCarthy that he would do better than he thought if he ran there. And he convinced McCarthy. And so he did run there. And it was that campaign probably that tipped Johnson into realizing that he couldn't win, that his position was weaker, that the support of the establishment was collapsing. It's right in the period that Defense Secretary McNamara resigned and the wise men came in. It was that period in which the whole United States felt like it was going through a nervous breakdown. And this was kind of act one of that. It was
And this was an interesting part of the book, I thought, because, I mean, Studs was really key to this whole thing in New Hampshire. And McCarthy, it wasn't like, okay, I'm good. I mean, there was some real convincing that had to go on here. And Studs, but he looked at the numbers and he looked at, you know, how, who voted how in, you know, the last, I mean, he was really good at crunching those numbers and figuring out, okay, where do we need to be and how do we get our message out? And he really was critical to that campaign.
He was a very good political strategist. People probably don't realize that about him, but he was. And I think history would have turned out a little differently if Studs hadn't done that. And I think he grasped that. And that was, I think, part of what convinced him to run for Congress later. So what happened next in his story was he left St. Paul's, took a second master's at Harvard. He really didn't know what he was doing with his life. He'd basically, at this point, you know, been pushed out of two jobs, the only two jobs that he'd had, and decides to run for Congress. Mm-hmm. He's living in Cambridge, but his permanent address is at his parents' house in Cohasset. And it's just an astonishing decision.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about that decision when we come up after a break. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. If you have some stories about Congressman Studs that you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear them. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Robert Snyder about his biography, Gary Studs, America's First Openly Gay Congressman. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to share any memories you have of the congressman. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we get into his run, first, I'm sure that people are thinking, well, how do you know what he was thinking? And you were actually lucky enough to get, he wrote a memoir, but it was never published. So that gave you a lot of insight into what he was thinking and going through.
Yes. After the Page scandal of 1983, he was approached by a publishing company He was really the only publicly gay figure. There were some elected officials at much lower levels. But he was in the news, you know, for 2 weeks, quite a lot. And he began a memoir, and it's really quite good, and it is nothing like most political memoirs. This was quite personal. It was not at all about what happened back in the committee rooms and how he made the political sausage kind of thing. Much more about his personal life, growing up as a confused gay person, having to hide his identity. So that's how I know a lot of the material.
Yeah. Following President Nixon's silent majority speech in which he condemned anti-war protesters, obviously Vietnam, we talked about that, you write, he was the most unlikely of candidates, and any political oddsmaker would have laughed off his chances of winning. Studs, just 32, had unhappily resigned from every job he had ever held. He had never run for political office. He was newly returned to Massachusetts, never having lived there as an adult. Scarcely anybody in his home 12th district even knew who he was. He had cast his own first vote in 1958 for the six-term Republican incumbent he now hoped to unseat. He had no money and would have to live with his parents. He was an unmarried man, keeping his sexual orientation a secret. He lost, but it was a close race.
Yeah, it was a close race, yeah. It astonished everybody. I spoke with this campaign manager, a man named Paul Nace, who recently passed. And Nace said that in the primary, his other opponents were much more traditional, locally elected officials. They never saw him coming. They never gave him a chance. And everybody thought he would finish dead last. But it was the war in Vietnam that was the major issue. And most of these candidates are talking about the kind of, you know, local issues that often congressional candidates talk about. And Studd seemed like the kind of person who could address national issues better than they did. And so he won, to everyone's astonishment, he won the primary, and then he went on to challenge Keith. Now, the heart of the district in those days, it was South Shore, Cape and Islands, and New Bedford were the three parts of the district. So here's Gary Studs with this kind of upper-class, you know, Yale-y background, and he really finds a way to talk to the New Bedford working class. Part of his secret there was he was a man of the sea. He did love to sail. He grew up sailing a small little boat. He liked to fish. He knew about the water. And he could talk to people about those kinds of issues. And he found that he hit it off pretty well with average working people. And he did very well in New Bedford, not enough to win in 1970.
But Hastings Keith did not seek re-election in 1972, and Gary Studs won the 12th congressional seat. As we moved to the, we'll talk about the redistricting a little bit later. But talk a little bit about his interaction. I mean, back then you knocked on doors, so it was kind of one-on-one. There were debates and things, but we certainly didn't have the kind of, you know, technologies we have running today. And he stood there at the factories as people were getting out of work, shook hands and talked to people. Talk about that relationship he had with the voters.
Well, after he almost won in 1970, he vowed that he would learn to speak Portuguese.
That's right, yeah.
Which many people in New Bedford spoke as a first language at home, and he did. And what it communicated to people was that this guy respects us. He knows who we are. He wants to learn about us. And it made him quite popular. And he took on the issues that were important to that community. It was, New Bedford was and is. It's a poor working class town. Lots of factories in those days, not as many, you know, today. But he had his eye on raising the standard of living, raising the minimum wage, getting federal money for jobs and education. And then, of course, the fishing issues, which we'll get to next.
Yeah, and he was believable. I mean, people believed he was going to do this, and he meant it.
Just
wasn't campaign promises.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about fishermen. He fought hard for fishermen and the environment, and one of the big key pieces of legislation he worked on was keeping the international fishing boats from coming into our waters. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, there's a terrific book about the transformation of the fishing industry called Cod by Mark Kurlansky. And Kurlansky kind of, I interviewed Studs as director of fishing, his advisor on this question, a guy from Harwich who was a fisherman himself. And the industry had transformed globally from the end of World War II until 1970. Many European and Japan and Taiwan, and Russia, their government subsidizes their fishing fleets. And so they had big boats with huge nets, and sometimes their two boats would sail a mile apart and drag a mile-long net, and they began sucking all the fish out of the sea. And this once inexhaustible resource, which gives Cape Cod its name, began to disappear off Georgia's Bank and the Grand Banks. So the question began to emerge in international discussions about changing the traditional 3-mile fishing limit to a bigger limit. In this period, Iceland and Great Britain, two allies of the United States, had a little cod war of their own, and they both moved to a 50-mile limit for their waters. And the idea began to surface here of creating a 200-mile limit. Now, Studs worked with a guy called Dan Young, who's still in the Congress. They were elected together. A Republican from Alaska, which has a big salmon fishing fleet. And in their second term, they succeeded in passing the 200-mile limit, which would now have to be enforced by the Coast Guard, which did intercept some Russian trawlers, doing illegal fishing. But it was an incredible transformation for the fishing fleet in New Bedford. And, you know, for every fishing boat, I'm sure there are several families that, you know, make their living off that one boat. So he was forever after highly regarded there.
And, of course, once you shift that responsibility out to the Coast Guard, then you've got the question of funding.
Yeah, so he was a big champion, a big champion of the Coast Guard all the way through his career. He was served on the Merchant Marine and Fisheries Committee, and he served on all the subcommittees of that, one of which is oversees the Coast Guard. So he was always fighting for the Coast Guard's budget.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the relationship with the page. Talk a little bit about leading up to that. He got wind that somebody was going to write something about this or release this information. He later on admitted that this was inappropriate and that his actions represented, as he said, a very serious error in judgment. But tell us about that whole incident and how it came to be and what the page had to say about all this.
Yeah, oddly enough, Studs, he shut down his sex life for much of his life. But oddly enough, when he got to Washington, he was more anonymous than he'd been in a very long time. You know, at St. Paul's, he'd been in a small community. And when you're running for Congress, you know, you can't quite go to a gay bar. Mm-hmm. And when he was in Congress, he realized nobody was looking at him. And he began to cautiously and then recklessly invite young men up for a drink. Actually, he had very little sense of who was gay and who wasn't. No gaydar. And he invited two people, young people who he met at bars, up for a drink and attempted to seduce them. They said no, and he said, okay, I'll call you a cab. But one young man agreed, and he later took this young man to Portugal with him as his driver, and they had sex every couple of days. He was 17 at the time, which was within the legal age of consent in Washington. They came back, and the page said, look, that was fun, but I don't want to do this anymore. They went their separate ways. And Studs probably took from this the lesson that he could do whatever he wanted. And he did for the next 10 years, and nothing came of anything.
So this was 10 years before it was revealed, we should mention.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. So in 1982, two pages came forward and said that male congressmen were harassing them. So the Congress opened an investigation into this, and they quickly found that the charges these young men made had no foundation. And in the course of it, however, they discovered that another congressman called Dan Crane of Indiana or Illinois, I don't remember, was conducting an affair with a female page. And I can't quite prove this because the records of the investigation were deliberately lost so as to protect people who were investigated and about whom nothing was found. But Joe Califano, who directed the investigation for the House Ethics Committee, wrote his own memoir, and this is one of the chapters in his memoir. And he says that, well, we continued to look. And they didn't want to come out of this with a democratically led Congress finding that a Republican, you know, turns out to be the person they're going to reprimand or censor. So they continued to look, and they found out this 10-year-old story. And those three pages who I mentioned all came forward, told you what I just told you. Mm-hmm. And the committee recommended a reprimand. A reprimand is kind of like a misdemeanor, not a felony. But Studs then, to the consternation of his aides, gave a defiant speech in which he said, I made an error in judgment, but basically this was none of your business. It was an affair between two consenting adults. Now, technically he was right. But my feeling is that most adults feel, I've been giving a few talks on this, and I often say, you know, when you're 17 years old, you feel like you can have sex with anybody, no problem. But when you're the parents of a 17-year-old, you look at this.
A different point of view, yeah.
You have a different point of view. And clearly the Congress had to do something. You can't, there has to be a rule and it has to be enforced. Probably a reprimand was the right thing to do. But hearing Studs' speech, Newt Gingrich, who was then the only Republican in the Georgia delegation, stood up and demanded that both men, the Republican and the Democrat, be expelled. And so the compromise was a censure, and Studs was censured. He kept saying to his aides, you know, this is going to come up on Bastille Day. He was a history teacher, and I kept asking those aides, what did he mean by that? Did he mean that he was a debauched aristocrat and the peasants were going to rise up and cut off his head? That's what I thought he meant. Mm. And one of them said, oh, no, that's not what he meant at all. What he meant was he was a prisoner in the Bastille, and now he was going to be free. He was going to be out. He could take a deep breath, and that is what happened. Yeah. He was a happier man.
And we should mention, this page did not come forward. The page was subpoenaed to testify.
Yes.
And was upset about that.
Yes.
And following that, said only good things about Congressman Studs.
Well, now everything that I've said on the radio so far is public knowledge. But the next part appears in the book, and nobody knew this. Okay. That page volunteered to work on Gary Studs' 1984 election campaign, and they became lovers. He's now a 27, 28-year-old man, and they resumed their relationship. So that's kind of testimony to the fact that Studs never hurt anybody, and it explains, it's part of the explanation for why Studs gave that defiant speech. He knew in his heart he hadn't done anybody wrong. He had never coerced anybody into anything, never promised some reward, you know, for...
Just on the flip side, I think there were people who would argue a 17-year-old, you know, in this relationship with a subordinate isn't. And I think Congressman Studs said that himself. It was inappropriate to have a relationship with a subordinate.
Yeah, yeah. It is. Yeah.
I wish Representative Crane was from Illinois. I just looked it up.
Oh, good. Okay.
You know, and I think it's easy for us to forget how difficult it was for someone in that time keeping his homosexuality a secret, that fear and isolation that he felt, obviously, from the what you see in his memoir. You know, so now here this secret is a secret no more. And there was some mixed reaction in the district, but more support than maybe he thought there was going to be.
Yeah. So I remember at the time thinking myself, this man's political career is over. He'll either resign or he won't run for office again. After the censure, he had a couple of meetings, one of them in Vineyard Haven, and people sat and they listened and they heard him out and he got a standing ovation. He had another meeting in a friendly town. He marched in the New Bedford annual parade, which he had done every year, and he got a warm reception from the crowd there.
Not from everybody, though.
Not from everybody. He also spoke in Marshfield and in Dennis, where he got a very hostile response. You had to anticipate this, in which he was denounced as a child molester and just, you know, as a homosexual in general. And he took all of this in, and then he decided he was going to run for Congress again.
Yeah. Now, before we get to that part, let's talk about his coming out. For a lot of people around the country who were in the closet, this for them was, maybe I can do the same thing. And some people came out with, you know, support, and others came out with their families disowning them. But he really was quite an inspiration to many people across the country.
Yes, he was. He got thousands of letters from people explaining their personal situation to him. Sure.
Yeah.
It was the first time people had seen this, and many people saw it in the newspaper.
But a congressman can do it. Why can't I?
Yeah. Now, we should bear in mind as well, there had been a gay liberation movement beginning in 1969 at Stonewall. And this did explode across the country, but mostly in big cities. And typically what happened was people in small towns who were gay migrated to San Francisco or New York. And so you had vibrant out gay communities throughout the 1970s. Gary Studs was so deeply in the closet that he did not participate in the 1979 gay rights parade. He voted, he did not sponsor the first gay rights bill during his first term in office. And I even interviewed an aide to Congressman Joe Moakley, whose office was next to Studs's, who was also in the closet. And I had a list of questions prepared for him about, what did you guys talk about during the 1970s? You must have been weighing all of this information about San Francisco and Harvey Milk, you know. He said, oh, I had no idea he was gay, and I don't think he had any idea that I was gay. Hmm. We talked about the normal things that you talk about in Washington.
Yeah. We should mention that march that you were talking about in 1969. He ran, like, jogging. Like, he wanted to see what was happening, but he didn't want to be part of it.
Yes,
but
right, the 1979 Gay Rights Parade.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Mark Robert Schneider about his biography, Gary Studs, America's First Openly Gay Congressman. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation or you have a thought about Congressman Studs. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so he comes out and he runs again, and people loved him. I mean, you know, you had go back to New Bedford. You had people saying, yeah, maybe I don't agree with that, but he's done right by us.
Yes, that's right. He had a good record, especially on coastal and environmental issues. He was popular not only among New Bedford factory workers and fishermen, but also with Cape Cod conservationists as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he worked very hard on all kinds of local issues that never made it into the book, you know, because they're just a little bit below the radar. But people all over the Cape, for example, knew, you know, he'd done work on pollution issues at the Otis Air Force Base.
Yeah, there's so many things he worked on. Because I thought about that. I'm like, how many of these issues can we fit into the hour? Because there's so much that he worked on.
Yeah.
And I want to get into a little bit of that. But let's talk to Ann first, who's giving us a call from Edgartown. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just listening to this conversation, and I was not living here full time then. I was actually probably in my late teens, and so I remember Gary Studs, but I didn't know any of this history, and so it's really fascinating to learn about. But what I was thinking as I was listening was just if the author could talk a little bit about what writing this book has made him feel about what's going on in the world today and the challenges of being sort of different from everyone else and trying to get your message across and trying to have the courage to be as good a person as he obviously was. Yeah. And I was just wondering, what you were thinking about, what this book has taught you about the way people are and will be always in what we do to elect better leaders.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. That's a great question. This book, I hope, will inspire readers with optimism. I taught world history for about 10 years, and my sense is that prejudices against same-sex-oriented people have been universal throughout human recorded history, probably some exceptions to that, but in general that's the case. Certainly so in Western civilization, and especially so after the advent of Christianity. This entire matrix has collapsed in the Western world. It is an astonishing transformation in the cultural frameworks in which we live. And it suggests to me that human beings are capable of change and transformation for the better. And when you stop and think of the world that Gary Studs was born into and consider that he ended his life as a happily married man, it's breathtaking. Mm-hmm. And I believe that in parts of the world today where anti-gay prejudice seems to be fixed and permanent, parts of, say, Islamic civilization, I don't think that's going to last there either.
Mm. Yeah. Anne, thanks for that question. That's a good question. I want to go back to 1983. We had the redistricting, which in itself was kind of a concern. He was going to lose New Bedford. But talk about the 80s. AIDS research was a big area that he worked in and was very, very upset that there wasn't more money allocated to that and that people were dying, and he didn't feel like the Reagan administration was addressing this.
Yeah. By the way, the redistricting was 1990 after the 1990 census.
Yeah.
We'll get to that later. But, yeah, so the Reagan administration completely ignored the issue of AIDS. Even his sympathetic biographer, Lou Cannon, concludes that this was one of the darkest spots on Reagan's presidency. He was surrounded, or he appointed, people who were Christian conservative, family values, bigots, who didn't want to talk about this issue at all. And it wasn't until Rock Hudson died of AIDS in 1985 that Nancy Reagan prodded him into changing his views. But it was far too little too late. And in the interim, thousands of people died way ahead of their time. Now, there were a couple of issues that needed to be addressed. The biggest one was money for research, education, and care. So that's, kind of finding a cure, prevention, and care for people who were ill. And the Reagan administration budget just kept ignored. They kept flatlining this. Congress would readjust it somewhat. So Studs now became a big spokesperson for this, especially mm-hmm. for prevention. Right. So he mailed to everyone in the district the report written by Surgeon General C. Everett Koop. And, that finally by the end of his term, the administration did send out a version of the Koop report. That was probably Studs' biggest contribution.
Yeah. Also, we mentioned in the beginning that he was instrumental in limiting President Reagan's wars in Central America. That was an area that he really became sort of expert in.
Yes. So this is an interesting story. When he was elected to Congress, he served all the way through on Merchant Marine and Fisheries, and then he had another assignment on transportation. Now, in 1974, there was a revolution in Portugal. And it set off a wave of revolutions in Africa, Portuguese colonies. And there was only one person in the Congress who spoke Portuguese, and that was Gary Studs. So they asked him to join the committee, and he served on foreign affairs. And then in 1979, there were revolutions in Central America, and Gary Studs joined the Western Hemisphere subcommittee, and he became the hardliner on that. I interviewed the committee chairman. And he was the hardliner. No aid to the military government in El Salvador. No aid to the Contras. He stuck to his guns all the way through. He made several trips to Central America. And it was Gary, the way I came to write the book, actually, is that I had written a previous book about Joe Moakley, who was the Boston congressman who led the investigation into the murder of the Jesuit priests in 1989. And it was Gary Studs who convinced the Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, to assign Moakley to that job. And it transformed the last 10 years of Joe Moakley's life. And for Studs, that was a continuation of his own work. So he contributed greatly, I think, to the ending of those wars.
Yeah, those murders of those Jesuit priests, I remember that was such a shock. Yeah. Such a terrible, terrible thing to happen.
Yes.
Right, let's talk to Peter, who's giving us a call from Yarmouth. Hi, Peter.
Yes, I think one of the strong points of Gary Studs' tenure was that he communicated well with the constituents. I was one of his constituents at that time. And he'd hold meetings in different towns, and you could ask questions. And if you didn't get your question answered, you could follow him to the next town and ask it again. The other thing I liked very much was his newsletters, which he started early in his tenure, multi-page newsletters. He really knew what was going on in Washington. But I think some agency of the government stopped him from sending those out eventually. But he was a very good communicator with his constituents, and I think that was one of his strongest points.
Peter, thanks for bringing that up. That's a good point. You talk about the newsletters in the book, which you know, he was a good communicator, and he listened. You know, not only to his constituents but his staff, which not all politicians do.
Yeah, he was a magnificent orator, and he liked that kind of New England town meeting interaction with people. Of course, for an historian, this was a real goldmine because I knew what he was doing every week. So it was...
And the other thing, just I know there's so many issues we could talk about, but going back to his interest in the environment, I was maybe a little bit surprised to learn that he was talking about global warming back in 1989.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he picked up on that right away. He had worked the other issues environmentally that we didn't discuss were he worked to limit drilling offshore. And also was successful in writing legislation that transformed the way we transport oil by sea. He tried to get that done after the wreck of the Argo Merchant off the coast of Nantucket in 1976, but failed. But in 1989, after the wreck of Exxon Valdez, which could have been prevented by the legislation Studs fought for in 1977, they did get legislation through on that, too. Yeah, global warming, too. He got that right away.
Yeah. Before I get to the retirement from Congress, he had a couple of rocky, I guess, election cycles, if you will, the redistricting and some of the... I was surprised at some of the contests he had where he had one where there was actually a candidate came up and he was expecting him to shake his hand. He actually karate chops him in the chest. I mean, it was like pretty shocking stuff.
Yeah, that was in 1984. That was Peter Flynn, his opponent in the Democratic primary after the Page scandal. Yeah, after that, he did have a couple of closer and closer elections. In 1990, the district was changed, and so New Bedford was separated from Cape Cod and the South Shore. So Studs lost New Bedford, and he gained Quincy. But he won those elections, too. Yeah. He was then about to become chairman, which he did become, of Merchant Marine and Fisheries, which is a pretty important post in the Congress, and especially for a coastal district like this one. So he did win those elections.
Talk about his decision to not seek re-election and retire from Congress.
Before I do that, can I talk a little bit about gays in the military?
Yeah, sure. Okay. We've got about 4 minutes left.
That's his signature issue. Mm-hmm. Gary Studs became the outstanding spokesperson in the Congress on the gays in the military question, and he fought for an end to that ban. Now, he didn't live to see it succeed, but he laid a lot of the groundwork for that. And a few years after he died in the Obama administration, we dropped Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Gay people have now served openly in the military for the past 7 years, and there's never been a problem with it. So we were really worried about nothing for a very long time.
Yeah, there were some really outrageous cases I remember in the book where he actually had an aide who dealt specifically with that. And you look at some of these cases and you just go, wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, so talk about his decision to retire from Congress, and he wanted to basically have a quiet private life.
After he lost New Bedford in the next election in 1994, the Republicans swept Congress. Newt Gingrich, who had persecuted him during the Page scandal, now became the Speaker of the House. Gingrich dissolved Merchant Marine and Fisheries and, you know, kind of reassembled it and separated out its subcommittees into different areas. So not only did Studs lose his chairmanship, typically a chairman then becomes the ranking member, but he now was a man without a committee, and he felt lost and powerless, and he'd about had enough, and he wanted to live a quiet life, and he went to the old Wailing Church in 1996 and announced that he wasn't going to run again in the 96 election, and ended his career, and kind of lived happily ever after.
Yeah, so let's talk about the happily ever after. Talk about Dean, and they had a commitment ceremony, but then gay marriage became legal, and they got legally married. And I love the dog was the flower girl.
Yeah, right. So Massachusetts led the way nationally in permitting gay marriage. Dean Hara, who had been living with Studs for a number of years, and Gary married. And, you know, he just kind of enjoyed a private life. He did not intervene in politics or offer advice to Bill Delahunt, who followed him in office. So, yeah.
Yeah. So talk about what he did after. He, for a while, he was tried to get the Oceanarium thing going in New Bedford. And he had a couple
He had a couple of other projects. None of them really actually worked out too
well.
But
he seemed happy.
He was happy. He was consulting on things that mattered to him, the ocean environment,
And so talk about his death. What happened?
He was out walking the dog. He was 69 years old, and he suffered an aneurysm. His father had died at the exact same age, and his paternal grandfather had died earlier. He hit his head when he fell and suffered a subdural hematoma. Now, you can fix one and you can fix the other, but when you get them both, the cure for one works against the cure for the other. He was conscious in the hospital for 10 days, and ultimately he passed.
Yes, what a sad ending. So what prompted you to write this book? You never met Gary Studs. So what prompted you to write this
book? No, I never met Gary Studs. I sensed that this would be an important and interesting and kind of complicated story. My own emotions, I knew before I started it, would be, you know, complicated about, you know, the Page, you know, story. And there's one other aspect of this for me. I had been a Central America activist, and I still go back there myself. And in the early 80s, Studs was the outstanding spokesperson in the Congress for peace in Central America, and I greatly admired him for that. And so that was another reason I wanted to write the book.
Right. Mark Robert Schneider, the book is Gary Studs, America's First Openly Gay Congressman. We'll have a link to more at our website, capeandislands.org. Mark, thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This was great fun.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.